I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, debate over how the U.S. will arm Syrian rebels. Turkey could become the first consolidated Muslim democracy of the 21st century.
These demonstrations are not against anyone or anything. They are for respect for individual rights.
Iran's president-elect hails his win in the country's election. And the U.N. hopes a new constitution in Yemen helps children. It's all ahead. Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning the West to be careful in arming Syrian rebels. Mr. Putin said at a joint news conference with host Prime Minister David Cameron Sunday that Russia is supplying arms to the legitimate government of Syria in accordance with international law, and he called on his G8 partners to do the same. Mr. Putin said his government and Britain continue to press for talks between Damascus and the opposition to end more than 2 years of violence. The Russian leader said he did not think Western plans to arm the Syrian rebels or establishing a no-fly zone over part of the country would jeopardize those international talks. Moscow has opposed arming the rebels while honoring its own commitments to supply weapons to Damascus. Prime Minister Cameron acknowledged the differences.
Now, it is no secret that President Putin and I have had our disagreements on some of these issues. But what I take from our conversation today is that we can overcome these differences if we recognize that we share some fundamental aims: to end the conflict, to stop Syria breaking apart, to let the Syrian people choose who governs them, and to take the fight to the extremists and defeat them. President Putin and I have discussed how we can use the G8 to bring new momentum and leadership to start negotiations, to deliver a transitional government, to keep Syria intact, and to stop the killing. We agreed that the G8 must back the work of Secretary Lavrov and Secretary Kerry to bring Syrians into a new peace process. And we will use the opportunity of having G8 leaders together to try to build on this common ground. But where there is common ground is we both see a humanitarian catastrophe. We both see the dangers of instability and extremism. We both want to see a peace conference and a transition. So the challenge for the G8 and for this process is to try and put aside some of the differences and to focus on the common ground where we both want to see a peace process, a transition, take place. That is going to be the challenge for us in the days and the weeks ahead.
United Nations says the civil war in Syria has killed about 93,000 people over the last 2 years. Most of those have been civilians. The United States is moving ahead with providing weapons to the Syrian rebels, but there are questions over how to do so. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshra reports.
Experts agree there is a military imbalance between Syrian government troops and opposition forces. Damascus has a wide variety of weapons, including thousands of tanks, helicopters, jet fighters, heavy artillery, armored personnel carriers, and chemical weapons. For decades, first the Soviet Union, and now Russia, provided Damascus with arms. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad indicated recently that Damascus has received a first shipment of a Russian air defense system that could deter foreign military intervention. The opposition forces don't have heavy weapons or helicopters. They are essentially armed with assault rifles, machine guns, anti-tank rockets, and a few shoulder-fired missiles. Experts say much of the weaponry used by the insurgents has either been captured from military depots, taken from soldiers of the Syrian army who have defected, or purchased on the black market. Reports say countries such as Qatar and Saudi Arabia are also either providing funds to the rebels to purchase weapons or are directly supplying them with arms. Analysts say in an effort to restore a military balance, the European Union recently lifted its arms embargo on the Syrian opposition. John Pike, head of globalsecurity.org, a firm specializing in defense issues, says the international debate over how to intervene in a regional conflict is not unique.
This is exactly the same debate that we were having 20 years ago over Bosnia. We had an arms embargo. They were massacring their own people. And eventually the policy that we came to was what they called lift and strike. Lift the embargo and strike the oppressor. And after a few weeks of that, Milosevic, the Serbian dictator, was brought to the table.
The United States has decided to provide arms to rebels after an intelligence report found conclusive evidence that Damascus used chemical weapons, including sarin, on a limited scale. But some analysts believe arming the Syrian opposition is fraught with danger. Fawaz Jurjis, with the London School of Economics, says it is difficult to determine who should receive military aid.
You have about 300 armed factions inside Syria. There is no unified command and control. There is no unified vision that unites all the armed factions inside Syria. It's chaotic, it's fragmented, it's decentralized. This fragmentation lies at the very heart why the armed opposition inside Syria has not been able to deliver a decisive blow to the Assad government. In fact, the divisions among the various armed factions inside Syria has been a great liability, and it has allowed Assad to go on the offensive, in particular, in the last 4 months.
John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is also wary about providing weapons to the Syrian rebels.
It's very hard to find white hats in that conflict. There's nothing good to be said about the Assad regime, but there's very little good to be said about most of the key leaders of the opposition, which is now shot through with al-Qaeda and other terrorists and radical Islamist factions.
Mona Yacoubian, a senior analyst with the Stimson Center in Washington, takes it one step further.
From an American interest standpoint, of course, there are lingering, continuing concerns about whether or not such arms would end up in the wrong hands, in the hands of jihadist extremists who have an agenda that is inimical to the interests of the United States. And there's also the issue of the fact that this is a sectarian civil war, and in fueling or providing arms to one side, does the United States and others become essentially partisans in what is a sectarian civil war?
Up to now, the United States has been providing the Syrian opposition with only non-lethal assistance, such as medical supplies, communications equipment, and water purification kits. But the Obama administration has come under increasing pressure, especially from Republican lawmakers like Senator John McCain, to provide the anti-Assad forces with heavy weaponry, especially since Russia is going ahead with plans to deliver to Syria advanced anti-aircraft missiles. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
If Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan respects the will of his people, Turkey can become the first consolidated Muslim democracy of the 21st century. That is the observation of Sonar Çaptay, director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, in an article published by the New York Times. We spoke with the author recently. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be with you, too. Well, first of all, why do you believe Turkey could possibly become a consolidated Muslim democracy?
Well, because Turkey already has some of the groundwork laid for it. It has a large middle class. In the last decade, thanks to the AKP's, the governing party's prudent policies, Turkey has become a majority middle class society. And I believe in the modernization theory that when societies become majority middle class, its citizens start demanding rights that go with that development, such as respect for individual freedoms, freedom of media, freedom of assembly and association. And I think this is exactly what we're seeing in Turkey. These demonstrations are not against anyone or anything. They are for respect for individual rights. So this is the rising Turkey, but also its rising middle class that is now demanding stronger respect for democratic rights and freedom.
I noticed in your article, The Middle Class Strikes Back, you write, the idea that economic development leads to more democracy is actually being proved right now in Turkey.
Absolutely. And I think, Turkey for a long time was a country which always had a middle class, but the plurality of Turkish citizens and a majority of them would be considered poor and working class. That is no more the case. As of 2010, a majority of Turks became middle class. And by the end of this decade, about 80% of the Turks will likely be classified as middle-class citizens. And this is, I think, driving the demands, the idea that protesters are taking to the streets to tell to the government, you might be democratically elected and you might have half or more than half of the country support you, but also respect our rights and freedoms. And I think this is going to be the trend you're going to see in Turkey, whether or not the demonstrations fizzle out this time. The protesters will probably come back to the streets again with stronger demand for respect, individual freedoms, as well as their rights. So I think Turkey is actually, despite the tumultuous phase it went through in the last 2 weeks, it is on a good and positive trajectory overall.
Well, what role did Prime Minister Erdogan's leadership style play in the unrest in Turkey?
Many people believe that Erdogan's style of governance, in which he dismisses dissenting views and largely does not take into account what the opposition thinks, has helped build up frustration against him, and that some of the demonstrations we saw was as a result of this frustration. I think what is really interesting in Turkey is not that. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets to protest the government's decision to turn a park in downtown Istanbul into a mall. That in itself is important. It's a large pro-environment rally where people try to save trees in a park. That's important. But what is even more important is that when the police moved in to crack down on the sit-in, the pro-environment sit-in, hundreds of thousands of people poured in to the streets in the middle of the night to defend the right of the sit-in protesters. So this was, I think, a very interesting development in Turkey where thousands and hundreds of thousands of citizens across the country basically said, we may not agree with everything they're doing and they're saying, but we want to defend their right to protest. And I think that in itself is signals the arrival of a mature middle-class society in which people are defending each another's rights to defend, to protest, and to dissent from government's views, whether or not they like those views.
I smiled when I read your statement that Mr. Erdogan has pushed to remake Turkey in his own image.
In a way, he has. I think Erdogan is a very powerful leader. He has won three successive elections, all with increased majorities. Each time he has won more votes. He's a very successful and charismatic politician. At the same time, though, he has amassed a significant amount of power. His government is the longest ruling government in Turkish history ever since Turkey became a multi-party democracy in 1946. He's been in charge for 11 years. If he wins the elections next year and the year after, he's going to basically run Turkey for about two decades. At the same time, his government, because Turkey is a parliamentary democracy, controls pretty much all three branches of government right now, both the executive and the legislative branches, and also appoints judges to the high courts. So this is more power than any leader has had. Probably since Ataturk made Turkey in his own image in the 1920s and 30s as a secular European-style republic. I think now Erdogan's vision is obviously a different one than Ataturk's. He still wants to make Turkey a powerful nation. He still wants Turkey to compete against the Europeans. But he also sees it as a country in which religion and piety has more of a life in public life, in education and government. And I think this is how Turkey is being remade in the image of Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan.
Well, do you think this mighty oak is going to bend a little bit to the wind of the middle class?
Well, probably not, because Erdogan is also realizing that he has support in the country. I don't think the demonstrations are a signal of support for Mr. Erdogan slipping. I think what we're seeing is that about half of the country supports Mr. Erdogan and the other half does not. What's happening is not support for him slipping, but it is rather the other half that does not support him rising up, taking issue with his style of governance. So I think we're going to see a country that's deeply polarized despite its economic growth and phenomenal success story between the supporters of the government and its opponents. And that might mean periods of strong demonstrations and political instability in Turkey. And that will be a contrast to the country's ongoing economic, great news of economic stability and growth coming from Turkey. Ultimately, it's up to Mr. Erdogan to decide to what extent he wants to push the demonstrators away and to what extent he wants to embrace them, because Turkey's stability is his success. But that success also helps him win elections, and he wants to maintain that stability.
Well, thank you for speaking with us, and good luck with your forthcoming book, The Rise of Turkey, the 21st Century's First Muslim Power. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you very much.
Sonar Çaptay, director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. Iran's president-elect Hassan Rouhani has hailed his win in the country's election as a victory over extremism, as thousands of his supporters celebrated Sunday in the streets of Tehran. In his first public statement since Friday's vote, the reformist cleric called his election a victory of moderation and intelligence over extremism. Many analysts see Rouhani's surprise victory as a popular repudiation of the conservative hardliners in the race. The president-elect has vowed to improve ties with the international community, although Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has the final say in all strategic matters, including nuclear policy. Dennis McDonough, the White House chief of staff, was asked about the election during a Sunday television appearance.
notwithstanding the very difficult circumstances the Iranian people went to the polls under, lack of press freedom, lack of transparency, harassment in many cases, I think we should all be quite proud of the way that Iranians turned out to vote and to express their democratic views. I see it as a potentially hopeful sign. I think the question for us now is, if he is interested in, as he has said in his campaign events, mending his relations and Iran's relations with the rest of the world, there's an opportunity to do that. If he lives up to his obligations under the UN Security Council resolutions to come clean on this illicit nuclear program, he will find a partner in us, and there will be an opportunity for that. But to get to that point, we need him to live up to the obligations on the nuclear program. And if he does, I think there's a great opportunity for Iran and the people of that storied country to have the kind of future that they would think justifiably want.
Israeli President Shimon Peres says Sunday he hopes the new Iranian leader will bring change to the country's policies.
He says he will not go for these extreme policies. I'm not sure that he specified what will be his policies, but it will be better, I am sure. And that is the reason why the people voted for him. And it surprised all the experts and all the prophets. And that is really intriguing me. Why? Because apparently there are hidden forces and strength that were unseen or unestimated at time. And the carriers of this hidden strength are the people.
Mr. Rouhani, a former chief nuclear negotiator and the favorite of reformists, earned slightly more than 50% of the vote, close to 19 million out of nearly 37 million counted. His closest competitor among five other candidates was Tehran Mayor Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, who received about 16% of the vote. Turnout was more than 70%. The United Nations Children's Fund says it is optimistic that a new constitution being drafted in Yemen will improve the dire situation for children in the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says Yemen's ongoing national dialogue is giving the agency an opportunity to engage with decision makers who hope to establish a new constitution, possibly in the next 2 to 3 months. Julian Harnais, UNICEF's resident representative in Yemen, says the guarantee of clean, sufficient water and the definition of a child as someone under age 18 are the two issues UNICEF wants to see included in the constitution. Harnais says women and children have access to about 6% of Yemen's water. The rest is used for commercial farming. Harnais says about 20% of the population is registered at birth, so most people do not know their age. Yemen has signed an international human rights treaty that sets the age of a child as below 18 years. But Harnais says this is not reflected in the country's legislation.
So, for example, the child marriage, there is no age to prevent child marriage. We see significant percentages of the population who are married before the age of 18, both girls and boys. We see children who are married at the age of 9, 10 years old. Obviously these are shocking issues, and there's no law which even refers to this.
Harnais says Yemen's laws on the death penalty are unclear, so people who are children when they were alleged to have committed crimes are due to be executed. Currently, 25 children are in death row. As Yemen struggles to recover from political and civil strife, Harnais says hundreds of schools are destroyed or damaged. He says the nutritional situation in the country is poor, with 255,000 children suffering from severe to acute malnutrition.
People not physically having access to food because of conflict or lack of money. But then there's also chronic malnutrition and stunting. And in terms of stunting, about 58% of the country is stunted, I do apologize. And that is amongst the highest stunting rates in the world. Chronic malnutrition is very much more a sort of development issue. It's about behavioral norms. It's about breastfeeding, hand washing, access to clean water, etc.
The recruitment of child soldiers was particularly acute during Yemen's civil war. Now that the worst of the fighting is over, Harnais tells VOA the problem of child soldiers is still an issue, but active recruitment has stopped. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.